You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, you might have a Chihuahua with no chill, a German Shepherd who will protect you at all costs, or a Labrador who wants to be friends with everyone. We want to hear from you. Does your dog's personality match up with what you expected from its breed or mix of breeds? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's the deal. Popular knowledge and organizations like the American Kennel Club say, hey, when you're getting a dog, you got to do some research, find out which breeds match up with your lifestyle and personality. If you love spending time on the couch, get a Greyhound. If you've got endless reserves of energy, get a Russell Terrier. According to a new study, though, a lot of these personality traits don't have that much to do with a dog's breed. Researchers at the University of Massachusetts and elsewhere, they surveyed over 18,000 dog owners, and they did genetic testing on a couple thousand dogs to find out what determines dog personality and behavior. Half the dogs in the study are mutts, half are purebred. They found that a dog's breed only accounts for 9% of personality and behavior variation among dogs. More important factors include age and sex. Even those aren't very significant. All right, there's the study. Now we want you, your data. We're talking about your dog, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Does your dog, current dog, past or present dog, does their personality match up with what you'd expect from its breed, the stereotype, or does your dog run contrary, different from what you thought it would be based on the breed? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, we asked around Wisconsin public media. This is going to shock you. When we asked our colleagues about their dogs, they had a lot to say. Hope Kerwin, WPR reporter in La Crosse, says, I have a Greyhound. She is the laziest dog I've ever met, which seems to be a common personality trait for a breed. When Hope was first looking at Greyhounds, she writes, I was so surprised that they have a reputation for being a 45-mile-per-hour couch potato, and that's definitely what Katie is. She loves a good sprint around the backyard, but spends most of her time asleep on the couch. That doesn't sound too bad. I could live that way. Well, how about you? 800-642-1234. Does your dog's personality match the breed stereotype? Oh, look, lots of you are calling. Fantastic. Connie starts us off in Portage. Connie, hi.
I just wanted to let you know, we've had four English Bulldogs now, and we just got our fourth puppy. Their personalities, all four, were completely different. They really were. This one is just a real little stinker. We can't get her trained. She's bullheaded as heck. She's just totally different than the rest. They were more easygoing. So just to let people know, they're all different.
Connie, I got to ask, though, there's obviously something about English Bulldogs that keeps you coming back for more. What is it?
Oh, because they're so sweet. They are the sweetest, and their face is real squishy, and we just kiss them and hug them, and they're just the sweetest dog ever.
All right. What's the little stinker's name now, the current one?
It should be something awful, but it's Lily.
Lily. Oh, what a nice name. Connie, thank you so much for starting us off at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Ray in Dodgeville. Ray, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to share with us, Ray?
I just wanted to share how quality of a Cavapoo is. I've heard so much about them being affectionate, but I wound up getting one during the pandemic, and it turned out to be a very loving dog. It doesn't take away from other dogs, as I've seen other dogs that the trait has been falsely shown, but it's how you raise them when it comes right down to it. I think even with children, it's how you raise them really shows the difference of how affectionate they're going to really comply with you.
Gotcha. And Ray, I'm sorry, I missed it. What was the breed again?
A Cavapoo. It's a crossbreed between a poodle and a St. Charles Spaniard.
Gotcha. Fantastic, Ray. Thanks for spelling that out for me. We are asking you, based on some current research now, does your dog's personality match up with what you expected from the breed of the dog? Some research says, hey, you know, these breeds, they're pretty recent, historically speaking, and a lot of this behavior is going back thousands of years, so a lot of this personality doesn't come from the breed. We want to hear your firsthand data. 800-642-1234. Okay, your firsthand anecdotes. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. John is with us in Baronet. John, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What's your story, John?
Well, about 5 years ago, my cousin raised his German Shepherds up in Escanaba, Michigan, and had one he couldn't sell, so I went and got it. I thought he'd be the perfect dog because I leave, you know, my house is unattended most of the day. Figured he'd be a good yard dog. Well, he's the biggest sissy you've ever met. he's just a big, he thinks he's a lap dog. All he's interested in is chasing his ball, and if a rabbit came up and bit him on the foot, he'd stand there and look dumbfounded. Like, what was that about?
German Shepherd, John, that's a mighty big lap dog.
It's a bite, yeah. He wants to climb up there. Like, you know, you can't let him. He weighs about 90 pounds now. So. But, yeah, he didn't turn out anything like, I mean, he's the best dog I ever had. I love him to death. But
awesome.
Not what I was expecting at all.
John, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Appreciate it at 800-642-1234. Jill Nadeau, Larry Mueller Show producer and fill-in host you hear on the air sometimes, says, my rescue dog Seamus is a mix of a lot of breeds, so he's amazing. Well, I don't know if that proves or disproves the science, but it's good to hear about. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tracy is with us in Spring Green. Tracy, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your dog story, Tracy?
My parents, years ago, got a toy poodle. We actually got it for my mother, who we had always been mutt people. And we'd always gone to the, you know, Humane Society and gotten whatever mutt nobody else wanted. And then my mother, after the last mutt died, made some comment about how she'd always wanted a toy poodle as a girl. And we all sort of scrunched our noses up and said, a toy poodle? But Mother's Day was coming, so we decided to get her, as a surprise, a toy poodle. Well, this toy poodle turned out to be the calmest, most laid-back, silent dog ever. He was so laid-back and quiet. He kind of kept to himself, but he was affectionate, too. And so after having the experience of that dog, when I decided to get a dog of my own, and I was an apartment dweller for many years at that time, I thought, well, I'm going to get one of those. They don't shed. They don't make any noise. They're perfect. And I got my wonderful dog, Fred, who is now gone, and loved him very much. But he was the yappiest, most anxiety-ridden little dog anyone could ever have. And I raised him very similarly to the way my parents raised their dog. And that's just the personality he came with.
Luck of the draw, I guess. Tracy, thank you so much for sharing both those stories with us. I appreciate it. Let's go to Angela now in Waukesha. Angela, hi.
Hi.
What's your dog story do you have to share with us, Angela? And does the personality match the expectation?
It does. My husband and I are Chihuahua people, and we have two rescue Chihuahuas, and they are little dogs with a big personality. They like their pack, they like the Chihuahuas, but not other dogs so much. Or other people all the time. So they kind of fit the personality that we thought we'd get. And we love them and we adore them. And all 3 pounds of fluff, they think they're a lot bigger than that.
So. And that's what you wanted going in, Angela, right?
Correct. We love rescues and we love Chihuahuas a lot. So they're perfect. They're perfect just the way they are.
Wonderful, Angela. Thanks a lot for that. Hey, I have an update on this Cavapoo. Our producers found a picture. It's a pretty adorable dog, actually, I got to say. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Madison now. Hi, Karen.
Hi. So I have two mutts. They're primarily American Staffordshire Terrier with other breeds. One of them is kind of a medium-sized dark brindle, and she is the sweetest dog you'll ever meet. She loves everyone. She loves to roll around on the ground and play. Just absolute sweetie. She will bring you toys to share. we call her our little socialist liberal. And then we have another one who is small, mixed with a French bulldog, mostly white, and very, very nervous and very jealous. And she will actually prevent the larger dog from eating because she'll run back and forth between the food dishes because she wants to be the one to control that, even though she has plenty of food. And she'll try and be big and tough, even though she's tiny. And we call her our little Republican because she just can't let anyone else have anything. So, but they're both very sweet dogs when they feel like it.
Karen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We are talking about your dogs, and you can too at 800-642-1234. A new study says, you know, all those stereotypes we associate with a dog's breed and the personality they have, well, at least according to this one study, there may be other research out there. They matched up genetics and personality and found they don't always match up so well. How about you and your dog, past, present, or future? 800-642-1234. Does your dog match what you stereotype, what you think about that breed? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll get back to more of your calls coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about dog personality. A new study found that breed only accounts for about 9% of a dog's personality. So maybe our stereotypes about a breed and their personality doesn't really always add up. Well, we want to hear your experience at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Sandra is with us in Williams Bay. Sandra, hi.
Hi there.
What's your dog, Sandra?
So my dog is a Louisiana Catahoula. Sometimes they call him a leopard dog because of their markings. He's Blue Merle, and he's a rescue from a ranch in Texas where they were breeding them. And they are the state dog of Louisiana, but not AKC recognized yet, I don't think. So it's a breed in formation, but they're becoming a lot more popular. They're not a huge dog, but they're not small, like around 45 pounds, and just tremendous athlete, super smart, and so friendly. He's friendly to other dogs, to people, 100% confidence in that. So just great dog.
I love it, Sandra. Thanks a lot. Now, if I recall correctly, the blues legend Clarence Gatemouth Brown has a whole song about a Catahoula, an alligator-eating dog, he calls it. So go find that. Check it out, Sandra. Thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Gretchen in northern Wisconsin. Gretchen, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about Gretchen?
Well, I have a mixed terrier, and he's exactly like a terrier. He's a little terrorist. I love it. This is our third terrier. Other ones were Boston Terriers. They pretty much aligned right up with that. But they're all very loving, affectionate dogs, and they know the hand that feeds them. They follow me a lot.
Love. And what's his name, Gretchen?
Rufus.
Rufus. I love it. Thanks so much for sharing that. We are inviting your calls. Does your dog's personality match what you think of for their breed or lack of same? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We asked around Wisconsin Public Media, David Baffa, education producer at PBS Wisconsin. Got two beagles. They both show certain personality traits associated with the breed, an obsession with sniffing and following scents and so on. But they differ in really significant ways. One much more stubborn, one more anxious, one loves chasing toys, the other uninterested in said toys. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Corey is with us in Milwaukee. Corey, hello.
How are we doing today?
Good. What do you got, Corey?
I got Louie. He's a Cocker Spaniel Poodle mix. Mm-hmm. He's man's best friend. He does whatever you want him to do.
And do you expect that going in with a cockapoo, right, they call that?
When I first met him, I think he had his own personality, but we kind of meshed. We worked it out in the middle.
Wait. How much did you change for your cockapoo, Corey?
I probably gave him a little bit more leeway than I should. We're in Milwaukee. We live right off of Brady Street. He is the tail wagging champion of the Brady Street Dog Walk Festival.
Excellent, Corey. Louie trained you well. Thanks for sharing the story at 800-642-1234. Rana is with us now in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. We have his and her dogs at our house. My husband wanted a Brittany Spaniel. It matches his personality perfectly. They're both running around trying to do too many things at once, chasing their ball. Oh, there goes a rabbit. Got to go that way. And they are just overly ambitious. My little mutt is a Welsh Corgi and Schnauzer cross. So she's wonderful, loving, a little protective, great at wagging her tail and making friends with everybody. So we have one of the true breed and one Mutsky. And my vote is for the Mutsky always.
Rana, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. We are taking your calls about your dogs, their personality, and how they match or don't match what people might expect from the breed of dog or the mutt nature of the dog. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kelly joins us next in Madison. Kelly, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Kelly?
Well, I, first of all, think it's kind of a disservice to frame that study the way that it said, that that a dog's breed doesn't really affect the temperament, because I adopted a little farm puppy, a border collie, Australian cattle dog mix, thinking with that mindset that, oh, it's all how you raise them. You just train them, you socialize them, and you can have the kind of dog that fits in your life with your family. But she, despite all the socializing and all the training, she's still a cattle dog. And I stand up border collie. Like, all of those traits come through. The high energy, erratic, always want something to be occupying her mind. And
I gotcha, Kelly. You're kind of breaking up. But I think we take the point. Your dog does match what you'd expect, that standard in terms of behavior. And again, the researchers aren't saying 0% match. Just saying maybe not as much as we might think. Thanks again, Kelly, for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Gretchen joins us next in Eau Claire. Gretchen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You've got what, Gretchen?
I've got a rough-coated collie. He's my first dog, and I'm 65. But anyway, he's so loyal and sweet and gentle, and he's the peacemaker around the house. No arguments allowed, so he steps between anybody who's not getting along, and he's just, I don't know, so smart and intuitive and so loyal.
And Gretchen, did you, when you were getting a collie, did you do it for that reason? You were hoping to get that loyal, intelligent peacemaker?
Well, I didn't know exactly. My uncle had a miniature collie when I was growing up, so that's about the only thing that was stuck in my mind, and I wanted a big dog. And Kai is huge. He's about 85 pounds. So, yeah. Anyway,
I love
it. Everything I wanted and more. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear it, Gretchen. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We are taking your dog stories for just another few minutes. The personality, the breed, do they match in your mind? 800-642-1234. Christiana is with us now in Appleton. Christiana, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about Christiana?
I have a Chihuahua, and she really likes to lick everybody, which is not what you'd expect from a Chihuahua.
Right, because people, I think of Chihuahuas as kind of like yipping at people and, you know, standoffish, and I'm, you know, they're tougher than you are. But yours is more friendly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love it. Thank
people
you.
Like her.
Sounds. Yeah. No Sounds problem. Like a fun dog, Christiana. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Rick is with us next. Now, Rick, what's your dog?
I have a golden retriever, and I guess I'd just like to make the comment, although it's certainly true that any dog can have a specific personality, working dogs that have been bred, particularly the sporting dogs or herding dogs, or when I say sporting dogs, I mean the retriever breeds, mm-hmm. they're bred specifically to be part of the team, the way we work the dogs in the same way that herding dogs work. And I think that's why you'll find the popularity of golden retrievers. They want to be part of the team as opposed to, let's say, pointers, which have been bred for hundreds of years for different things where they work independently. And they're sort of, I wouldn't say indifferent, but less inclined to sort of want the teamwork. So I'm not sure what that study was looking at in terms of personalities. But if you talk to professional dog trainers that work with working animals, not show dogs, but working animals, they'll tell you there is a definite difference in not only their behavior, but particularly instinct. So the retrievers want to retrieve, the pointers want to point, the hounds want to track. And it's just an observation anecdotally, but I believe it to be true.
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Harry joins us now in Hayward. Harry, hello.
Gosh, I'm hitting up again on a shout out on the Golden Retrievers. But yes, I'll sort of paraphrase what the previous caller said. And they are sniffers. They will pick stuff up, but they will also sell their soul for a tennis ball. And their loyalty is one that I had a golden that when I was up on a roof, working on a roof, she would try to get up on a ladder and got up about three rungs. So they are they're good dogs, and they've changed my personality to theirs. So that's what I can say for the goldens.
Excellent. Harry, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Thanks to everyone who called in. I appreciate it. A lot of great stories. Maybe in trouble with my coworkers now. A lot of them shared stories that I didn't have time for because you called in. But hey, listen on. I might share some more other stories over the course of the next week. And by the way, there is still time to share your story of your dog's personality and whether you think it matches up with what you expected when you got it based on, you know, the breed and background and whatnot. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Always happy to hear more dog stories along the way. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, are we likely to find life on other planets? And if not, should we plant it there? A UW biologist looks at some of the practical and ethical questions around some of this terraforming. I'm a big science fiction fan. Love to hear from a scientist about this. Plus, it's a great time to get outside, but be sure to take some precautions against ticks and Lyme disease. We'll get practical advice from a DNR Lyme disease expert. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a U.S. Supreme Court expert explains how overturning Roe v. Wade, if that does in fact happen, could affect other legal precedents on major cases in recent years. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Starbucks announced it will increase wages for non-unionized employees after a string of successful union votes at outlets of the coffee chain. We'll check out the impact of unionization on non-union workers and some of the rules behind these union drives and a company's response. First, in the leaked draft opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade, Justice Samuel Alito writes that, quote, "Our decision concerns the constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion," end quote. So many pro-abortion rights activists and others have raised concerns that if Justice Alito's reasoning stands when the court hands down its decision this summer, many other rights could be at risk. That includes same-sex marriage and relationships, access to contraception, and interracial marriage. The Roe v. Wade decision argues that under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, people have the right to seek an abortion. That amendment has been used to establish many other rights, such as the right for same-sex couples to marry, the right to use contraception, and the right for consenting adults to have sexual intimacy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns that if this ruling as written stands, it could bring other rights, other past rulings into question on things like same-sex marriage, interracial marriage, other big Supreme Court decisions over the years? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Benish is an associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Her work focuses on the Supreme Court. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, in this leaked opinion, Justice Alito said, hey, no, this is just about abortion, not any rights unrelated to abortion. Can you talk about that part of his, again, draft ruling and how it could or could not apply to these other precedents I mentioned?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Justice Alito is very careful to note in a couple of places in the draft opinion that this applies only to abortion. But I think it is fairly simple for him to say that, and a little bit harder to argue that some of the holdings in this draft opinion would not also apply to same-sex sexual intimacy, contraception, same-sex marriage, those kinds of issues. The court in this draft opinion does really delve into the history of the right to abortion. And their argument is that the right to abortion is not protected in the Constitution, and only those things that we can say are deeply rooted in our nation's history are so protected by that 14th Amendment's liberty interest. Once they dive into the history, then they find that there have been abortion statutes on the books since the 1800s. And so for that reason, the right to abortion isn't something that would be protected. You might be able to tell then that if we were to apply that same reasoning to something like same-sex marriage or even same-sex sexual intimacy, we would also not find there to be any sort of historically rooted right.
Can you talk about the use of the 14th Amendment in these kinds of cases where, in effect, they say, hey, we, the federal government, via the court system, is going to say, hey, you, the states, you can't restrict these rights, even though they're not enumerated in the Constitution. These are some liberties that you don't have the right to overrule. Can you talk about that as a basis for a lot of these decisions we're talking about?
Yes. For a long time, the Supreme Court has interpreted the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause as conferring substantive rights. That's not uncontroversial, and that's something that Justice Alito talks about in his draft opinion, because the words of the 14th Amendment protect process, right? So you can't be deprived of life, liberty, or life, liberty, or property without due process, meaning you have to go through certain steps, that the government would have to go through certain steps to take those things away from you. But the court has over time found that anything that we deem to be intrinsic to our ordered liberty, something that without which our nation doesn't have the characteristics that we think our nation must have, anything that are fundamental rights are also protected under that due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And so something like privacy, which we all sort of expect as a human right and expect in terms of our ability to choose how to live our lives, is not something that's in the Constitution, but that the justices have found to be implicit in our system and something that is fundamental to our experience as citizens. So anything that the court has deemed to be intrinsic to our ordered liberty, something that's fundamental, deeply rooted in our nation's history, has been deemed to be protected by that 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, even though it's nowhere explicitly stated in the Constitution.
Now, Justice Alito, again, says this applies only to abortion. We're not talking about this other stuff. Some people have pointed toward Justice Alito's dissent in the Obergefell decision. That's the same-sex marriage one, making exactly, if I understand this correctly, I'm not a lawyer, making exactly this argument that, no, the 14th Amendment shouldn't apply here. So could that come up in a future challenge, say a state law restricting again same-sex marriage?
Yeah, that's exactly the argument, right? That if we are to take this position, which is also shared by Justice Thomas, was shared by Justice Rehnquist in past courts, that the 14th Amendment confers only that procedural due process, then anything that doesn't have a constitutional textual basis would be open for state decision-making. So, of course, the draft opinion doesn't take away the right to abortion. It just finds that it's not protected by the Constitution, and so leaves open the question to the states to make those decisions. That would also be the case with same-sex marriage.
Sarah Benish is with us, associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at this draft Roe v. Wade decision that would, if it stands, if it goes into the summer, would overturn Roe v. Wade and what it means for other precedents that people may have taken for granted. Same-sex marriage, the right the idea that states can't restrict contraception, for example, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hello.
Hello. The reason I'm calling is that going back on a little different angle on this subject, one thing that's bothering me is that we also have constitutional guarantees in the practice of religion, freedom of religion. And I'm not a Muslim, for example, but I do understand that they don't consider a fetus really a whole person until the end of the first trimester, when you receive your the number of breaths you're going to breathe, your talents, and your soul. And so the question that I'm getting into here is the what's the foundational argument on the part of the court on freedom of religion versus interfering in this whole process of telling people we may or may not have an abortion, either at state level or federal?
Jack, thanks for the call. Sarah, I've seen some people argue, people who support abortion rights, for example, who argue there may have been better avenues to pursue it. Jack saying a religious liberty angle.
So I'm struggling to try to think of the ways in which the religious liberty would play into the abortion question. Obviously, this is a highly moralistic issue about where life begins. And that is something that Alito explicitly says in his draft that he's not going to take part in the discussion over. And the Supreme Court has generally kept itself away from that decision. But of course, the statute at issue does call the fetus an unborn human being. And if states were to choose to delineate the fetus as an unborn person, then we'd have to get into a question of whether or not the Constitution confers any sort of rights on unborn fetuses as people. And that's another, you know, entire can of worms. But I think in terms of the freedom of religion, you know, in many ways, it's not implicated here because no one's being forced into any sort of decisions about abortion. And so I'm not exactly clear on where those things lie, though. Obviously, a lot of opposition to abortion is religious in nature.
Thanks for the call, Jack. Deborah joins us now in Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I'm concerned about Alito's saying that there is no history of abortion in the U.S. At the time the Constitution was written and ratified and the Bill of Rights was added, it was just common practice that a woman could end a pregnancy up until the point of quickening. And the Ninth Amendment should protect that right because it says that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage rights retained by the people. So why didn't he take that into consideration?
Deborah, thanks for the call. That historical argument from Justice Alito, I have seen other people, Sarah, make the case that there is some tradition of abortion being allowed in the early United States. What do you think of what Deborah had to bring up?
Yeah, I think that's exactly true, that there were abortions allowed. And in fact, this question of quickening was one that Justice Alito talked about in the draft and many states grappled with as they had their various iterations of abortion laws over time. But that's not exactly the focus that Alito is putting on this question of whether or not the due process clause includes a right to privacy or to an abortion. Because what he's looking at is whether or not there's a deeply rooted history in this country of recognizing a right to abortion. So allowing for abortions, the fact that they existed at the founding, that's all true. His contention is that there's no deeply rooted right that's protected by the Constitution under that 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. Of course, Deborah pointed to the Ninth Amendment. That's where a lot of the justices over time have deemed the privacy protection to lie. But the majority of the court has really focused most of its attention on that 14th Amendment due process right. And the way Alito's reading it in the draft opinion, it has to have some evidence that it's deeply rooted in our nation's history, that right be fundamental in nature.
Deborah, thanks for that call. Sarah Benish is with us, associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee, talking to us about other legal precedents that could be in question if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As we've heard, same-sex marriage, access to contraception, interracial marriage, all rights established using in part the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause and the right to privacy. Are you worried that those rights could be at risk? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Sarah Benesch, Associate Professor and Chair of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, who studies the Supreme Court. We're talking about the draft decision leaked that would overturn Roe v. Wade and whether the ruling could affect other court precedents. Lots of them, potentially. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, another precedent that people bring up is the case of Loving versus Virginia. I think a 1967 decision that said, hey, states, you can't outlaw interracial marriage. Justice Alito looking for this historical guarantee. He looks at the timing of the 14th Amendment just after the Civil War. Could somebody make a case based on that, that like, hey, interracial marriage wasn't the norm, wasn't necessarily allowed then, so we could challenge it now?
I suppose someone could make that case. I think that particular case is probably the hardest one to make, even under the Alito ruling. I think the idea that marriage has a deep root in our history is fairly clear. And so the right to marry is a very strongly recognized and fundamental right, even though, again, that's not in the Constitution. So I think it would be more difficult to make that case in terms of interracial marriage than to say make the case that this opinion would also have some ramifications for same-sex sexual intimacy, for example. So I think in those cases, the Supreme Court did much the same thing as Alito's doing here with Roe. So rather than recognizing and focusing on a right to privacy or a right to bodily integrity, Alito's really focusing on a right to abortion. In the same way, an earlier court in Bowers versus Hardwick focused on whether or not there was a fundamental right for homosexuals to engage in sodomy. And they found that there was no historical right, which is not surprising to anyone, right? When the court overturned that decision in Lawrence versus Texas, the court then instead focused on a fundamental right to sexual intimacy. And that was something that was far easier for them to find in our sort of historical context. So I think that, you know, that's a much closer corollary to what Alito is doing here with abortion than interracial marriage, although I don't think that this draft would be without implications for those kinds of questions.
Now, you also pointed us toward a ruling that I'm less familiar with on the right to refuse medical treatment, a Cruzan case. Could you tell us what that was and how it fits in here?
Yeah, I think that case was really focused very carefully on this right to bodily integrity and found that there is a fundamental right that does exist and is deeply rooted in history of a person to have bodily integrity, to be able to refuse medical treatment. And the court, the draft, I keep saying the court, this is a draft by Alito, doesn't talk about Cruzan in their draft opinion. And so sort of sidesteps this issue of this really fundamental and deeply historically rooted right that we have to control what goes into our body, what is done to our body, and those kinds of issues. And again, I think the focus on whether or not there's a deeply rooted fundamental right to abortion leads him to the conclusion in a way that focusing instead on a fundamental, deeply rooted right to bodily integrity would not.
Talking to Sarah Benesch from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the leaked draft Roe v. Wade overturning ruling and what it might mean for other precedents in the U.S. Supreme Court. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Steve is with us in Chippewa Falls. Steve, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, my question is about whether we can pass a law that essentially codifies abortion rights in the United States. And from what I can tell, most Americans would support that. But also you can make this to meet your today's topic, you know, to codify the right to gay marriage or any other one of these subjects that you're entailing. And my question is this. If a law is passed by Congress and the Senate and signed by the president, that's the law then, right? I mean, or does the Supreme Court have the ability to say, no, that's not the law? Because it seems to me that an abortion law, you know, something in the style of a European abortion law, could pass the Senate. We already have Murkowski and Collins bringing forth a potential law that more or less codifies Roe. with the exception of a very, very late term abortion. And it seems to me that even my friends who are pro-life would, at some level, they'll be on board for like a 12 or 15. Oh, sorry, my daughter's here. But
that's
I'm
okay.
Let it go at that.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Sarah, I mean, part of the argument in the courts sometimes is, hey, this shouldn't be the courts doing this. This should be legislatures. But our caller raises the question, you know, if Congress says, yeah, abortion access has to be legal in all states, could a state still challenge that? And maybe a Supreme Court say, no, Congress, you can't do that.
I think the Congress certainly has the ability to consider that kind of legislation, provided it has the political will to pass it. And of course, we know that that will be difficult given the makeup of the Senate in terms of a filibuster-proof majority. And yes, the Supreme Court could then consider a challenge from, say, Texas or Oklahoma that suggests that that oversteps the federal government's power. And so then the Supreme Court would have to decide whether or not the federal government has the power to put forward that kind of a requirement. And of course, it would depend on what the wording of the requirement said and those kinds of things. But yeah, certainly the Supreme Court, through Justice Alito's draft, is talking a lot about the role of courts versus the role of legislatures. And their contention is that when the Constitution doesn't forbid something, that those are instances when the states and the elected representatives of the people need to be the ones to take action rather than the courts.
Thanks for that call. Sarah, on a wider note, one question here is, how willing is the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn precedent because the makeup of the court is different, saying, hey, the five of us think the seven justices back in 73 just plumb got this wrong? Do you see potentially this conservative majority on the court being a little quicker on the draw when it comes to being willing to do that kind of thing and overturn past rulings?
Yeah, that's good spotting, Rob, that it seems like there's a difference in the makeup of the court over time. And that's why we see differences in the makeup of the court's decisions over time. So it's absolutely the case that the ideology of the justices and their preferences and their interpretive strategies for the Constitution matter to the outcomes that they reach. And when a majority of the court is no longer in line with precedents that are, especially precedents that are old, the court really doesn't have a whole lot of a problem overturning those precedents. And so I think the fact that Roe versus Wade has stood as precedent with some revisions after Planned Parenthood versus Casey for all of these years without overturning, even though many solicitors general and many other litigants asked the court to overturn it, suggests that there's something special about the makeup of this court. And I think we are all recognizing that this court has a larger majority that is of conservative bent than any court we've had for a very long time. And so it's not at all surprising that this would be the time that they would start to look at overturning this precedent and others.
In just our last minute, what would it look like for new precedents to end up at the court? Will we see things like abortion has been over the last bunch of years, where states pass things to try to get them to the Supreme Court to put them to the test? Or could we see things like that, for example, with same-sex marriage?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's every time we have a major and divisive public issue, there are litigants that are ready and waiting. There are attorneys that are ready and waiting to test the limits around whatever rules the court puts forward or whatever sort of situation the new court looks like it might be open to. And so this statute that the court is considering in Dobbs out of Mississippi is one of those statutes. There's a host of them across the country. There have been lots of regulations of abortion over time that have provided the opportunity for the court to make policy if it chose to do so. And so I think if this draft ends up to be the final one and Roe versus Wade is overturned, we'll see lots of test cases coming up through the courts to try to look at those other issues that you've raised as potentially being implicated by that decision.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Sarah Benish is an associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Sarah studies the Supreme Court. She joins us today to talk about the possible broader legal implications of overturning Roe v. Wade and other Supreme Court precedents that might be at risk now. Coming up after the news, some stores in the coffee giant Starbucks have held successful union votes. The company has fired some organizers and now says it may give new benefits only to non-union workers. We'll look at the particular case of Starbucks and what it means for labor in general. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.